So welcome back. We're going to go on with that last point that Steve Weinberg raised before he left, essentially, which is the faith religion issue. Actually, while this is up, just before I forget, this is a painting by Anselm Kiefer. That's by William Blake. But the other one is called Sternenfall, which means starfall, and I've loved this painting for a long time. Anselm Kiefer is a German artist, absolutely brilliant German artist, who was born in 1945 and has wrestled with these issues of heaven and faith and so on. He was in a monastery for a time, and he wrestles with the sort of issues of Nazism and the Holocaust and so on. And I looked at that painting and I thought, well, God, you know, at some point when we get to the morality issue, I mean, here we have... this puts me in mind of Kant, you know, the starry heavens above me, the moral law within me. And so I got in touch with the curator of an exhibition where this painting was showing, and he said, well, that's funny. He said, that's exactly what was in Kiefer's mind. He'd been thinking of that. And that's actually a self-portrait. That's Anselm Kiefer lying on the ground, pondering these enormous issues. And I wrote to him and asked him if we could use this as one of the defining images for this thing, and he said he was very happy to do it. So I just thought I would mention that. We'll go on with the issue that Steve set up for us. We'll be going to Joan Roughgarden. Just before we do that, I just want to have Terry Sanofsky, who's the chair of the advisory board for the Science Network and director of the Computational Neurobiology Lab here, and a Howard Hughes medical investigator and a professor of just about everything under the sun, to say a few words about Francis Crick.
Especially those who have visitors who have traveled some distance, on behalf of the Crick Jacobs Center for Theoretical and Computational Biology, which I direct here at the Salk Institute. Can I have the slide?
Slide.
Oh. Francis, if he were here, would have much to add to our discussion. He was, as many of you know, a devout atheist, which is not to say a militant atheist. He probably did more than anybody I know to demystify the nature of life and the nature of consciousness. In fact, he was working on that problem on his very last day here on Earth. And I think it would be appropriate to quote from his last book entitled The Astonishing Hypothesis, which, as you know, was the hypothesis that everything that we think and that we feel is a product of our brain, which is something that is obvious to some neuroscientists, but not so obvious to most of the people here on this planet, as we heard earlier. And this excerpt is taken from the last chapter entitled Dr. Crick's Sunday Morning Sermon, which is perhaps appropriate for today. And this is toward the very end as he's summing up. General ideas, especially moral ones, impressed on us at an early age, often become deeply embedded in our brains. It can be very difficult to change them. This may help to explain why religious beliefs persist from generation to generation. But how did such ideas originate in the first place? And why do they so often turn out to be incorrect? The very nature of our brains evolved to guess the most plausible interpretation of the limited evidence available makes it almost inevitable that, without the discipline of scientific research, we shall often jump to the wrong conclusions, especially about rather abstract matters. Amen.
So, Joan, said a godly voice from across the room, would you like to join us and say your piece? Joan Roughgarden, let me just make one apology, first of all. In the list of recommended reading at the back, There is a significant omission, which is it just fell off in the typing process, which is Joan's book, which is outside with the at the in the lobby with the UCSD bookstore. The fact that it's not here does not mean it is not recommended reading. It is recommended reading. And so Joan will follow up on the point that that Steven Weinberg started. She's professor in the Department of Biological Sciences in Stanford. And her current book is the Darwin book, Evolution and Christian Faith. But the one before that, which I highly recommend, is called Evolution's Rainbow, Diversity, Gender, and Sexuality, which is a complete eye-opener. So, Joan Roughgarden.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and for the opportunity to speak. And in the spirit of a preparing a conversation, what I'd like to do is react and extend some of the points that were raised earlier. First of all, with respect to where I'm coming from, as was just mentioned, my previous book, the one before the most recent one, was called Evolution's Rainbow, and about gender and sexuality and nature and also in people. And one of the principal conclusions of that is that one of the branches of Darwin's writings, the branch that pertains to sex roles called sexual selection theory, I think have concluded is entirely incorrect and on the wrong track. And so it provides us with, apart from the truth of that or not, it provides us with an interesting test case of the willingness of the scientific community to see someone challenged, whom we hold at least in the status of a hero and possibly in the status of a prophet. Now, the most recent book that I've done, called Evolution and Christian Faith, is quite a bit different. It's a very small book. And it's motivated specifically by the need to have some material for the people whom I envision and know personally as people of faith and who are wondering what evolution is actually about. So in a sense, what I'm going to be doing is putting some different perspectives on the table. If you consider what went before as the opening of a chess game in which a lot of pawns were put out on the table and some knights, then what I'm going to begin is to put some pawns on the table together with some bishops. But unlike a real chess game, both sides can actually talk to one another. So it need not end in a victory or a draw, but it actually could end in a bargained solution. Now, and I should say also by way of where I'm coming from, my parents were missionaries, and I grew up in Indonesia and the Philippines in the Episcopal Church tradition. And I left the church. I didn't quit the church or anything. I just sort of drifted away for many, many years until about 10 years ago when I had some very serious personal issues I was dealing with and returned to church at that time. So it's in the, over the last 10 years that I've been part of a religious community and so therefore have a sense of what the questions are that people are asking. And what was needed was a succinct statement of what evolution was. And also a friendly statement of what evolution was. And I employed a very strong fact theory distinction and simply stipulated that the main facts of evolution are two, namely that all of life belongs to a common family tree, and secondly, that biological species change through time in contradistinction to physical species. And I just simply stipulate those. And that also leads me to say that the book that I've just written is not a secular book, and it's not a book about general science. It's actually a religious book, and it's being shelved in the religious sections of bookstores. And then the theory of evolution, as I was saying, drawing a strong fact theory distinction here, theory of evolution is what explains the facts. And as you all know, the elements of basic Darwinian theory as we understand it today are that there is variation generated by random mutation, and then there is the process of natural selection, or which I sort of rename in the book, natural breeding, that operates on the variation and produces changes in the stock or the population. Now, one of the interesting things when I was doing the research for this was to be able to tell this basic Darwinian narrative in terms drawn directly from the Bible, because this metaphor of random variation and a randomness in the generation of variation and of a change in the stock through breeding must go back to the dawn of agriculture. And so therefore these very concepts are found within the Bible. And in particular in Genesis, there's an extended treatment about the farmer Jacob, who was a man of God, and his interaction with his master, Laban. To make a long story short, Laban had been beating up on Jacob over the years, and God said to Jacob, Jacob and Laban struck a deal that Laban could keep, or that Jacob could keep the cattle and sheep and so forth that were speckled in brown, and the other cattle and sheep would revert to Laban's ownership. And God spoke to Laban, to Jacob, and said that I will recompense you for the injustices you've found. And so, according to Genesis, God caused the rams, or the males of the speckled and brown cattle and sheep, to, quote, leap upon, unquote, the females and do most of the breeding. And as a result, the stock gradually changed through time to come to be consist of the type of individuals that Jacob owned. So in this way, the hand of God directly drove, if you will, the course of evolution in this species. Now, and you could just lift this passage and plug it directly into an evolution book if you wanted. Now, the issue of randomness is also a real red flag in a lot of these circles. And there's a parable that many of you may know about the mustard seed. And this is from the New Testament. And it has to do with Jesus discussing his concept of teaching, his notion of teaching. And he draws an analogy to a farmer who's going along, and as seeds drop off the end of the cart, the seeds land on shallow soil and on good soil and so forth. And those that land on shallow soil don't grow. Those that land on good soil grow and produce fruit 100 times over in 100-fold. And similarly, he describes his own teaching as though they were mustard seeds, that the teachings go out to the multitude, and those who are capable of hearing, hear them. Those who don't hear, don't listen, don't hear. But those who do hear then go forth and bear fruit. And this is basically the notion of randomness, that is throwing the ideas out to the multitude and just seeing where the messages are heard. So I even used the phrase in the book that a mutation is a mustard seed of DNA tossed into bodies at random, and then you see in what bodies those mustard seeds of DNA prosper, and in those bodies, then fruit is produced 100-fold. And so in this way, one can directly find passages within the Bible that can lead to an inherently friendly narrative about what evolution is. And that was a very sort of exciting thing to do, because you can then actually begin a discourse without the supposition that that you're automatically going to start a fight. Now, the rest of the book goes into, it has a chapter on intelligent design, and above all, my religious, if you will, or theological criticisms of intelligent design. It goes into a lot of other issues. It's rather than what I'd like to do now is to mention some issues that specifically came up this morning, and I guess what my sense was is that the discussion this morning was dealing with caricatures of both scientists and of people of faith, and I think that I think one issue involves the claim that scientists have heroes and not prophets. And I don't think that's obvious in the least. And I think that the status of Darwin in evolutionary biology at the moment is that of a prophet and not of a hero. And I think that anyone who seriously finds fault with an element of Darwin's writings that's not some sort of trivial fact is inviting suicide that only tenure can protect you from. So I just simply doubt the truth of the claim that scientists have heroes and not prophets. Secondly, there's an issue of whether science is correct. You see, if we're going to work with people who at the moment are anti-evolution or anti-science, and if you see these people saying, well, I believe the Bible, I don't believe scientists, are they idiots, as is in effect implied by the previous discussion? Now, on the other hand, is the science correct? I mean, what do we have to go by? Not a little while ago, estrogen was being recommended for breast cancer. Now it's a no-no. In point after point, you just never really know, if you're in the general public, what scientific assertion is correct. That's a big problem. You can say, okay, it'd be great if everybody were scientifically literate, but they have to be more than scientifically literate. They actually have to make a decision as to what elements of science at any one time are correct. And some are frequently not tested. Now, from that perspective, if you don't really know whether the science is right or not, then the credibility of the Bible rises in comparison, because the Bible has, after all, been around for a couple thousand years. And so it's not as clear-cut as this morning's discussion seemed to suggest. That obviously you should side with science and not with the Bible. Because if you don't know if the science is true, then what do you do? So it's not irrational for someone to relatively emphasize the status of the Bible. Now, another issue that comes up is the endorsement, if you will, of the rationalist model that science is rational, and as a product of the Enlightenment is something that we should endorse. That's great, rationalism. Now, as you must know, this is a dubious point. Is rational thought all that accurate, all that correct? And what about our emotions? What's the status of our emotions? For example, in the book, I said that actually to be a person of faith is to dignify the emotional. Do we actually require a rational argument for God, and is it a mistake to do that? How many people actually are people of faith and got to that position because of a rational argument? Almost no one, I would submit. And if we look at animals, what we find among other vertebrates, fish, all sorts of things, is a lot of reliance on body English, if you will. That's why animals have colors. They talk to one another with their bodies. We talk to one another with our bodies. We communicate, at least, in our bodies. We react to one another with our bodies. Rationality, great, but that at the very least is superimposed upon capabilities that we have that are broader. So, And of course, there's been a lot of feminist criticism of the rationalist model, you know, the use your mind to control your body. You know, it's distinct from a view of body or of personhood in which a person is actually a team of the mind and the body, and they both have to work together to pull it off. So it's the notion of listen to your body, listen to your pain, which is an entirely different intuition than the intuition of the rationalist ideal. And then there's the issue of the fairy tales. Does anyone really believe that a cracker that has been blessed is Jesus' body? It's obviously not a piece of flesh. The spirit of the teaching, though, of St. Paul is that we are all of one body, that everyone within a Christian community is of one body. It's an extended passage. It's a beautiful passage, and it has to do with the claim that as members of a Christian community, we all suffer if one of us suffers, and no one individual from the community can be amputated without the community as a whole suffering. That's the sense of the body metaphor runs throughout St. Paul's teaching, and the act of having the cracker and so on is an act of joining in the Christian community and being of one body in that way. So you don't need to suppose that there is some ridiculous irrationality in someone who does go through that ritual and what it implies. Also, there's a great faith in the rational model to yield answers to ethical problems, which I'm personally very suspect of. I've attended meetings at the Stanford Medical School about biotechnology. My observations of bioethicists discussing biotechnology is that they're like lawyers trying to figure out a way for biotech companies to do whatever they want. I can't see any evidence of values which are being developed from a rationalist perspective. Instead, it's a complicated weaving around of different faith groups, all of which are viewed as lobbyists for certain values. And so it's a maneuver. And so I ask you seriously whether or not you really do think that a morality could develop or form within a rationalist context and a completely a religious context. And so they're the main points that I wish to mention is that I think that there has been so far, if I look at the chess table and the pieces on the table, an exaggerated and highly rose-colored picture of the capability of science that's been put on the table. And I think that there's a ludicrous caricature of people of faith that has been put on the table. And I don't think either is accurate. And I invite you, if you're interested actually in us, there's another point I need to mention. And that is concerning the accuracy of science. I mean, someone made the remark that when they read Physics Review, they see a bunch of junk papers and they don't worry about it. And that because they know it'll be found out. But actually, the same might be said about teachings from the Bible as well, is that at any one time there are a number of teachings from the Bible that are incorrect. And if you actually do bother to read the Bible, it's very helpful in being able to sort out the claims that are being made from about the Bible that are not actually there. But the bigger issue is whether or not the suite of hypotheses that are being considered by scientists actually do explore the hypothesis space very well. And the homogeneity of our peer group is definitely preventing us from laying on the table hypotheses about nature which have a good chance of being correct. Those hypotheses almost invariably involve cooperation rather than competition. They involve cooperation rather than selfishness. They emphasize the body rather than the gene, the body and teams rather than replicators. Now, as we all know, the sociology of science is not welcoming to hypotheses which really do differ from those that are taken as accepted. Basically, the sociology and the peer review system and the grant awarding system rewards the generation of hypotheses that extend those held by the power centers. Now, in connection then, just to close on this note and to close the circle here, if you do look at the science of gender and sexuality in biology, it's almost surely incorrect top to bottom. It's a worldview of nature that postulates that gene pools consist of dirty genes, that the objective of males and females, or that males and females originate actually in a state of conflict as sperm and egg fight with each other to see who does most of the work, and in which courtship between males and females amounts to a deception of various sorts. Alternative expressions of gender and sexuality are discussed in pathologizing narratives. And the application to humans is, of course, particularly funny because the human brain is explained as the human equivalent of the peacock tail, which of course poses a problem for why women have brains, because female peacocks don't have a tail, and so the existence of a male ornament in a female is problematic evolutionarily. So of course the answer is that females have brains to admire the brains of males. And you see the ludicrous and the idiocy that is associated with this ever enlarging body of narrative and not data about sex roles. And so in our time, I invite you to look at that body of literature and see it as fundamentally flawed, not fixable, and reflecting the bias of a basically sexual selection theory is locker room bravado projected onto animals and then retrieved from animals as though a fact of nature. So I invite you to see the extent to which there is bias and prejudice within science, and that we as scientists, as well as citizens, have a lot to gain by fostering a dialogue between science and religion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just picking up on Stephen's last image, Steve Weinberg's last image of the dear old aunt and whether she should be retired or whether we're actually going to keep her around for a long time, and the second part of the thing, which is the locker room bravado, I suppose, whether the science is accurate or not. When we were talking at lunch, Richard, you were motivated to respond to the Weinberg thing on the dear old aunt, and my sense was that you thought it was perfectly fine for the dear old aunt to be given the hook and we should move on to something that... Would you like to expound on that?
You want me to come up?
Yes, it'd be fine. So Richard Dawkins is the Charles Simonyi Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford and the author most currently of The God Delusion.
Well, I've been called out. I hadn't prepared anything. Dan Dennett has a phrase, belief in belief. Dan, as you know, is not here because he's been, as was thought, mortally ill, and thank goodness, in his own words, he's pulled through. One of the more memorable phrases of his book, Breaking the Spell, is this thing, belief in belief. There are many people who don't actually believe in religion, but who believe in belief in religion in the sense that they get a nice, warm, fuzzy, glowy feeling when they come across religion. They think it's a good idea for other people to be religious, although, of course, we're much too intelligent to be religious ourselves. But nevertheless, it's a good idea that there is religion around. And I wondered whether Steven Weinberg, who is a man I enormously respect and who is one of the staunchest atheists on the planet, was feeling the need to bend over backwards and be just a little bit nice about religion, scrape the barrel to find something nice to say about religion. And so we came up with this picture of the elderly aunt who we'll all miss her when she goes. I won't miss her at all. Not one scrap, not one smidgen. I am utterly fed up with the respect that we all of us, including the secular among us, have been brainwashed into bestowing upon religion. I'm coming on to what Joan Roughgarden said in a moment. What would we miss? Would we miss the music? Would we miss the poetry? Well, yes, we would. We would miss the music. The B minor mass, the Matthew Passion, these happen to be on a religious theme, but they might as well not be. They're beautiful music on a great poetic theme, but we could still go on enjoying them without believing in any of that supernatural rubbish. When I did Desert Island Discs, which is a program on British radio where you have to go on and name the half dozen, I forget how many it is, six records, I think, that you would take to a desert island. I chose Mache dich mein Herz rein from the Matthew Passion. It's the most beautiful, gorgeous piece of music. And the question mistress, Sue Lawley, couldn't understand how I could possibly choose a religious piece of music. You might as well say, how can you enjoy Wuthering Heights when you know perfectly well that Cathy and Heathcliff never really existed? It's fiction. It's good fiction. It's moving fiction. But it's still fiction. So I think there is an awful lot of bending over backwards to be nice to religion going on. Even Steven Weinberg indulged in it a certain amount today. But when we've lost religion, as I hope one day we shall have lost the appalling guilt that afflicts people brainwashed as children into being religious. We shall have lost the brainwashing of children, which indeed labels them as being, as belonging, as sharing the same religious opinions as their parents, a form of child abuse. We shall have lost the subversion of science, which comes from teaching children that faith is a virtue. Faith meaning belief without evidence. Children are systematically taught that there is a higher kind of knowledge which comes from faith, which comes from revelation, which comes from scripture, which comes from tradition, and it's the equal, if not the superior, of knowledge that comes from real evidence. Now, Joan Roughgarden has offered what I would call a poetic vision of science, which I think I would call poetic, although I think it's rather bad poetry. Trying to woo people of religion over to evolution by seeking out passages in the Bible which have some faint, vague, tenuous connection to evolution, the kine that were speckled and brown, the mustard seed, or not the Bible, but in the Christian communion service, the wafer as being in some poetic sense symbolic of St. Paul's view that we are all of one body. Why bother to express truths, if they are truths, why bother to make up a parable, to make up this tenuous allegory, when you can just tell people the truth. The truth is perfectly simple. Why bother with going back to the Bible and seeking out some sort of analogy? Why not just teach natural selection, teach evolution the way it is? It's perfectly simple. You don't need to this strained, unnatural seizing of a possible analogy from the Bible. It would be almost as though Crick and Watson's DNA structure were one day discovered to be false, and we all admit that science moves on, and maybe it would, this particular one I think won't be, but suppose that the double helix turns out not to be true. The sort of religious parable, the sort of religious allegorical thinking that we've had an exhibition of this afternoon would be similar to a scientist of the future saying something like this: well, of course, we don't literally believe in the double helix anymore, but let's think, what does the double helix have to tell us today? I mean, the intertwining of the two strands is symbolic of the, I don't know, human love or something of that sort. The purines and pyrimidines cross-linking is has some other symbolic, allegorical significance. Why bother with that kind of thing? It seems to me to be absolutely typical of what's wrong with the religious mind. Of course, I'm not now talking about the fundies who really do enter into science and simply get it wrong. I'm talking about the sophisticated theologians who probably don't actually believe any of it, or if they do, they hardly do. But they nevertheless keep it going by means of this sort of bogus, poetic, symbolic way of talking, when we actually understand, we're getting to the point when we understand the reality of the world. And then the thing about conflict and cooperation, cooperation rather than conflict, sexual relations as deception or cooperative, the locker room bravado. I really don't think it does science any service at all to drag in human emotive phrases like locker room bravado. If the current theory of sexual selection is wrong, then by all means expose it as wrong on scientific grounds, but not on emotional, quasi-poetic grounds. Well, I'm sorry, that was a bit of a rant, but I was unprepared, and I'm just reacting immediately to what I've just heard.
Would you like to respond to that? Richard, you want to stay up here? my take on that, just Joan Lovegarden. My larger take on that, if I may interpolate something, I may be completely wrong here, but my larger take on that was that a lot of the work that one reads in evolutionary biology these days actually does have. So it'd be interesting to get into the, on your last point, for example, about conflict and cooperation. There are some new papers emerging, which are rather interesting ones, about, in neuroeconomics, about group activity and so on and so forth, that I think that might be interesting to go into, but I'm not sure if that is a bridge there or whether there's a chasm, and perhaps if you could talk.
I guess the most relevant thing I could say to your interesting comments is that in the trenches, in some sense, we need to persuade a certain fraction. You've seen the statistics about the extent to which Americans are committed to or believe in evolution, so to speak, or are supported as an accurate picture. And certainly what I've seen a lot is that there's a huge middle zone there are some people who are creationists, but a great many of the people who are expressing skepticism about evolution would not identify themselves as creationists. They actually need an account that they can connect with. And so the reason for telling what we know to be scientifically true about evolution in as many dialects as possible is to help persuade a diverse community of citizens about this. And they're coming from different points of view, and some of them would be completely convinced by the facts of the matter, but others recoil at the almost techie type of presentation of the facts which is sometimes made. And that's the reason for poetry.
Yeah, I can see that, and it harks back to, I think, something that Michael Shermer was saying this morning about if it depends on what you're trying to achieve, and if what you're trying to achieve is to win over the hearts and minds of that large religious majority of the American population, then you've possibly got a point. That you want to woo them in using the sort of language that they understand. So I think this is probably a matter of political tactics. And I can see that if one's political aim is to, say, win the battle over the teaching of evolution in schools, then the sort of tactical... But I mean, in your case, I'm not sure it's tactical. I mean, I think you really believe it. But I mean, there are other people who feel that we should be conciliatory, and I think Michael Shermer called it making nice. And I think that there is something to be said for that. I'm genuinely uncertain about what I feel, because I can see the political benefits of winning that particular battle. I do see it as a battle rather than a war. I mean, I think it's a skirmish. And I mean, I'm actually much more interested in the deep truths about the universe. Is there, as a matter of fact, a supernatural intelligence in the universe? And that's the war that I'm really, really interested in. And to me, the evolution creation battle is a skirmish. But I can easily be persuaded that political it's a bit like saying, should you vote Democrat or vote Green or something, and you know, it's the lesser of two evils argument. But you don't even think it's evil. I mean,
well, no. I mean, I certainly don't think that any choice of imagery is is evil if it's still accurate.
Well, okay. I mean, I don't think it's accurate,
Could I just interpolate something? This is actually a large pivotal point in many of the pieces that one has been reading recently, the whole notion of whether it makes sense to take the kind of position that you've taken in the God hypothesis or the make nice thing, whether in fact it does harm to the overall community polarize them, whereas I think that what you would be saying is that they're not being, you're not seeking to polarize them as such, you're just hoping that they'll actually explore the evidence with more intense focus.
Yeah, I mean, you have to open the door, I think, and I think that the choice of imagery and the choice of language is important to get the door open. And I would agree with you completely on the issue of pursuing a critical analysis of religion. I don't think that religious thought and religious doctrine should be any less subject to scrutiny. And but what I would say, where you may not agree, is that is a good case for actually reading the Bible and making sure that you can check up on people who claim that there is stuff in the Bible that isn't actually there.
Do any of the members of the audience have, I mean, do you have any issue? Francisco, do you want to say something on this?
You want me to do it from here? Yeah, okay. Well, I was not planning to say something, but you asked and named me, so I'll get up. I got up. Yeah, Francisco Ayala, University of California, Irvine. I was frankly very disappointed with both talks. I happened to be speaking to two good friends of many years. I think we reached at least 24 years since 82, when we were jointly celebrating the centenary of Darwin at Cambridge, and were co-authors of a joint book with others as well. And I don't know whether it's earlier or later, where at least once and maybe twice I wrote blurbs for your books, commenting on how the books, how good they were, and they were, and your books are superb. Joan, I think I met her when she was a graduate student at Harvard, and I was a young assistant professor at Rockefeller University and came to give a seminar there, and then we went together for lunch, if my memory is correct. I think Ed Wilson had invited me to give that seminar. I was very proud, addressing the Department of Biology at Harvard when I was an assistant professor. And I have seen John more often than I have seen Richard. I think, John, you have presented the picture of science, which is a caricature. I mean, you bring up estrogen, and there are many other things which are wrong with conclusions or presumed conclusions of science, which are not very very established, but there are lots of knowledge that I think is well established to the extent that science can establish things. We all accept that it may very well be that the basic assumptions of Newtonian mechanics are wrong, and Einstein proved that. But Newtonian mechanics works, and by and large, is true knowledge. And I think in evolutionary biology, we both are practitioners of that, more ecological and behavioral side, more the genetic side. I think we have a lot of very good knowledge, very basic, and very useful to humankind. So at least the way your message came to me, I was disappointed. It seems to me that you were trying to put down science, and that doesn't go anywhere. I know how Richard feels about matters of religion. There are, I could agree with you in many things, which I will not make explicit here. But we cannot ignore religion, Richard. People, I mean, there are 6 billion people in the world, and if we think that we are going to persuade them to live a rational life based on scientific knowledge, we are not only dreaming, it's such an illusion. It's been like believing in the fairy good mother, you know, something like that. I mean, people need to find meaning and purpose in life, and they find meaning and purpose in religion. Now, the religion comes to them very much in the form of, you can call it indoctrination, it can be education in the family and otherwise in the schools, but this allows billions of people in the world to live a life which makes sense. They can put up with the difficulties of life and with the hunger and disease and the like. And I certainly don't want to take that away from them. I, for one, would rather see that 7% of members of the Academy of Sciences, my colleagues, who still seem to express faith in ways that I would not share, but I certainly don't want to take religion away from the people. It's much too valuable for them and for finding meaning out of the world.
I wouldn't if I were at somebody's deathbed and they had a deep religious faith, I wouldn't try to disabuse them. I don't necessarily want to take away what people have from religion. I was surprised that Steven Weinberg seemed to be almost expressing a kind of lament on his own behalf for the loss of religion. That really did surprise me. But I can see and, of course, acknowledge that a lot of people do get something from it. I was surprised he seemed to, I don't believe he does. And I wanted to disclaim any sympathy with that point of view. When I've been to, for example, religious and secular funerals, some people say, "Oh well, what are you going to do? How are we going to bury our dead if we don't have religion?" I don't know what your experience is, but for me, by far the most moving funeral services I've ever been to have been wholly non-religious, where they consist of eulogies for the dead person, readings of poetry, the favorite poetry of the dead person, the favorite music of the dead person, people reminiscing about the dead person. When there are prayers as well, you just start looking at your watch and waiting for the next for the next eulogy. My wife says that it's the prayers that are the only thing that keep her going, because if otherwise she'd be weeping all the time. She's so moved by the eulogies and the poetry and things like that. I think it's not a difficult task to devise alternatives to at least some of the rites and rituals that religion provides, certainly funerals, certainly marriages. Music, well, I've already said something about that. But I do agree with Professor Ayala that no doubt there are many people who need religion, and far be it from me to sort of pull the rug from under their feet. If they don't want to read my book, then they're welcome not to.
Francisco, thanks so much for your comment. And maybe this will go a little ways to alleviating your disappointment. And I'm obviously not saying that all of science or even much of science is incorrect, but at any one time, some of it is. And I think we as scientists, and this is my point, need to be sensitive to people, to lay people who can't tell which is correct. And so they then are put in the position of having to listen to authorities, and the authorities are usually chosen by the media. And it's in this context that some of the skepticism about science arises, and especially when it's delivered as medical prescriptions that they follow, that they then have to go back on and not do later. So I think from an educational point of view, and I know you're committed to science education, I think it would help if we were more sensitive to the inability of the general public to discern where the science is correct and where it isn't. And so to cut them a little slack on this when they do doubt good science, and that we should go the extra mile to try to explain what we are actually convinced of in terms which can reach different constituencies.
Okay. Larry?
Just say who you are.
I just have a quick question.
You say who you are?
Larry Hinman from the University of San Diego. I have a quick question for both the panelists, and that is, it seems like one of the dangers in a discussion such as this is that we compare the best of science with the worst of religion. You know, and I'm concerned that some of that happened earlier today. And I think particularly when we talk about best, it can be in either of two senses, either an epistemic sense, that is getting the story right, you know, or it can be in a moral sense. And I think some of the strongest force of Sam Harris's comments this morning, at least to me, came about from his deep moral concern about the possible damage that this commitment to religion could have. But it seems as though science, too, you're pointing out in part, I think, the dark epistemic side, perhaps, but it also has its own dark moral side. And it would seem like any discussion of these would have to look at both dimensions in both religion and science. And so if you have any comments.
Shall I go?
Yes.
Well, that's actually the sense in which I'm concerned with the view of nature that's implicit in the or explicit in the sexual selection narrative, because it's a view of social conflict as basic, as human nature and as biological nature. And if that's true, fine, so be it. But we haven't had a class of hypotheses on the table to challenge that. And because to do so actually does unfortunately trace back to Darwin, and it's not, I think, socially acceptable to be skeptical of Darwin in that regard. But that's what a lot of people are pointing out, is that there is that from this worldview comes a sense of ethics. It informs ethics, even if it's not value in and of itself. And I think we do have to worry about the moral implications of it, of scientific research, and I thank you for the question.
Do you have a thought on that, Richard?
I worry about the prioritizing of putting the emotional, poetic, moral implications of science ahead of the science itself. I mean, I don't actually care whether it fosters a locker room mentality or whether it fosters, whether it's about conflict or cooperation. I care whether it's true. And to take the particular example of the gene or the individual as the unit of selection, I don't want to approach that question by saying what is best for human society, what gives the best moral lessons for humanity. I want to approach it from the point of view of how Darwinian theory works, and so I want to say something like, in natural selection, what are the units that actually survive or fail to survive? Individuals are not that, because individuals, at least in sexual species, only exist in one copy each, and so individuals are not the sort of things you can count the frequency of. They're not the sort of things that whose frequency changes as generations go by. Genes are. Natural selection, evolution by natural selection, or indeed evolution period, consists of changing gene frequencies manifested in changing phenotypes in populations, and the gene frequencies change as a consequence of the survival or failure to survive, the reproduction or failure to reproduce of individuals that contain those genes. To the extent that male bodies and female bodies have different optimal ways of doing things, you're going to get particular male and female expectations. This is all scientific theory. It may be wrong, but it's science. We don't judge it by criteria such as, is it a nasty, ruthless, unpleasant view of the world? Or, I mean, wouldn't we all feel better if we had a nice, cooperative, friendly, unselfish view of the world? Well, maybe we would, but what matters is what's true, not what makes us feel good.
Yeah, but there's no disagreement on that point. The question is whether or not, as I mentioned earlier, the hypotheses that are on the table explore the space of all possible hypotheses very effectively. And this is where the sociology of the science comes in, because there's a non-random generation of hypotheses to span the hypothesis space. And the hypotheses that are generated have a history and a connection, and a connection with power and so forth. And so I agree with you that if nature is red tooth and claw, if that's the fact of the matter, fine. But has that actually been tested?
Okay, so I understand you to be saying that if that is the fact of the matter, then they'll have to live with that. But the effect of these political biases that you're talking about, yeah, is to restrict the range of hypotheses that we examine.
Yes.
Rather than to prejudge what we're going to end up, yeah, feeling is, yeah, true.
Nicely,
well, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, nicely put.
Beth, do you have anything?
Yeah, I was sort of taken with both talks, perhaps in contrast to Francisco. And it did occur to me that we do actually have an example of someone with both a religious perspective and with religious power on the one hand, but someone who wants to be scientifically accurate and not just a teaspoon of sugar makes the medicine go down, and that's the Dalai Lama. And it seems that he is genuinely interested in what the science actually says and doesn't want to soften it down, wants to have an accurate story and the most up-to-date story, both with regard to molecular biology, but certainly with regard to the brain. And his curiosity about this, I think, is really very interesting. It also seems to me, having been in one of these sort of tutorial sessions with him, that the metaphysical baggage that he brings to bear is really very, very minimal, and to the degree that it's there, it's pretty darn hard to see, or at least in the sense that he doesn't sort of foist it on you. What they do emphasize, on the other hand, is, and I think this is something that Joan is worried about, and it was something that Steve Weinberg was worried about, and that is the sense of community, the sense of belonging to a group that is not always easy in a very large country or in a very large city, where people can share things, talk about problems, and so forth, and typically religions do provide a certain amount of that. The other part of the story does have to do with ethics, but again, it's a kind of ethics that doesn't talk about rules and it doesn't talk about laws. It talks about acquiring certain virtues and certain skills for navigating the social world, where the specific form that that might take would depend on the nature of the conditions. What I'd love to see is that the Pope, for example, were as willing, even half as willing, as the Dalai Lama to learn the science and to change his mind accordingly. And perhaps it would be great if the Episcopal, I don't know what they are, bishop or top gun, were to do the same thing and to emulate the position that the Dalai Lama has taken, so that you emphasize what's important to people, namely community, learning to live a good life, meditating so that you are peaceful and not anxious and all those good things, and leave the metaphysics aside.
I guess I could say that the new presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church here in the U.S. was just ordained, or whatever the phrase is, this morning, and she's a scientist, and she was an oceanographer, and I looked up her publications for the time when she was active in science, and she was an expert on planktonic cephalopods from the California Current near the Washington-Oregon border. So it's highly specific, but it's highly taxonomic. But nonetheless, she definitely is a scientist. So it remains to be seen whether or not this provides, whether this will lead to study groups or new forms of dialogue between religious communities and scientists. I certainly hope so.
I think one of the points that Pat was making, though, is sadly, a couple of the people that were supposed to be here today, Richie Davidson has University of Wisconsin-Madison, who did a lot of the work on fMRI, of meditative states of the Dalai Lama's monks from Namgyal Monastery, can't be here with us today because he's got a prospective donor there and has got to go and do a presentation. Paul Ekman would have been here today, but his wife has been ill, so he can't be with us. But I think that this point of Pat's is correct, that we should... I mean, the fMRI work that has been being done by Richard Davis and other people is really very interesting and very instructive. And I think, you know, I've often said it's the neuroscience, stupid. If we start understanding a bit more of that, I think we'll have some better answers to some of these vexing issues, and perhaps the problems will be less problematic. Sam, do you want to say something? Since you are, did you want to come on down here?
Got a mic for him here.
Sam?
See, this is the director of the Hayden Planetarium who does this all the time.
He's got something to say himself, by the way.
What?
He's got something to say
Thank
himself.
You. Neil, yes, I know. Well, why don't you both come down here? That'd be much easier, if you don't mind.
Us both?
Yes. Because I think you both had responses to this.
I did have a response, but it's his turn.
That's all right. You can just leave the mic up there and come on down.
Okay, I can hand him the mic. That's fine.
Are you jet lagged?
You can just take a chair. Take a seat. I'll take the mic. Now, Sam, you've actually written on Buddhism, and you have an essay which I recall called "Kill the Buddha."
Yeah,
because you've taken.
Although it's
you,
not.
You
as
take it. It's obviously from that very old, what was it, 12th century monk or something.
Yeah, there's a koan.
But your position is that in fact. Well, why don't you say what your position is?
I just wanted to first respond to you, Joan, because I feel like. Something in my remarks struck you as a caricature both of religion and science, as you said, and I want to dispute that, although conceding several points to you. One is that the point that Richard conceded, which is it may be that there is room for different voices here, and it may be politically necessary to, at various moments, use the language of a community so as to draw them into an actual engagement with modernity. But you were saying much more than that. You were basically saying that it is highly doubtful that we can get morality really up on a foundation without believing something religious, without believing that one of our books is not an ordinary book, but may be the Word of God or may be the best book ever written, never to be superseded. And I highly doubt that. And I think when the conversation moves into morality, I want to try to give you a rational foundation, what I think is a truly rational foundation for morality, which is doesn't partake of any superstition. But the thing I want to point out to you is that it seemed to me you're pointing out the role of bias in science. You're saying that you can pick out individual scientists or individual theories or individual moments in science where scientists were just flat wrong and they were wrong based on their own biases. And that is a totally legitimate thing to do. It is a totally scientific thing to do. I mean, your bias in science is bad science. Bias in religion is faith, it's doctrine, it's redeeming, it's holy. I mean, you don't have the same corrective mechanism in religion. And just before you, I just want to bring in Pat Churchland's piece. The reason why neuroscientists are queuing up to meet with the Dalai Lama and not with the Pope is that there is a different discursive tradition within Buddhism right. than within Christianity and certainly within Islam. And, you know, the Tibetan Buddhism is, in its totality, being practiced as a religion by most Tibetan Buddhists in this world. But the Dalai Lama is a very sophisticated connoisseur of modernity, and he's interested in science. And there is an empiricism to Buddhism which makes legitimate the statement that you hear on the lips of many Buddhists that Buddhism is not even a religion. It's a philosophy, it's a mode it's an introspective methodology. And I hope to say something more about that. But the thing that has to be admitted in the spirit of science is that whatever is discovered by meditation, for instance, is not Buddhist. I mean, we don't talk about Muslim algebra. We don't talk about Christian physics. And there are good reasons why we don't, because those are real areas of discourse, and they got lifted out of the cultural contingencies where they were discovered. And we will not talk about Buddhist meditation, ultimately. And the Dalai Lama is unique among religious figures in that he will admit that.
Yeah, but I think those comments are very, very much on point. So two things. First, I express skepticism that we could have an ethics or a morality that was not derivable from a religious or faith tradition. That doesn't mean I'm not asserting, though, that that's necessary. I'm just skeptical. Because my experience with ethical discussions, which were taking place solely in a rationalist context and without any system of values associated with them, were inconclusive and seemed to me to be very open to manipulation, particularly manipulation for the profit motive and things of this sort. So I think it's an open question, and for someone who does actually want or envision the disappearance of religion in the modernity of the future, then there has to be some really hard work done on how to develop a system of values without that, and that's really hard. Secondly, I do want to speak to the point of whether there can be any critical analysis within religious thought. And if I may say, I think you're underestimating even within the Roman Catholic tradition, the role of critical scholarship. And I'm impressed at how much critical analysis there is on the subject of gender and sexuality within the Roman Catholic departments of theology. And I've personally been attending conferences at Loyola Chicago about this. And I've asked them, how does critical scholarship within theology, which examines the truth of or the biblical accuracy or justifiability of what is currently doctrine from the bishops and the clergy, how does theological scholarship get to them? You know, and can't they just do whatever they want as the clergy in charge, irrespective of what biblical scholarship is or theological scholarship is showing? And they've argued that, to me, that it's similar to the reaction to the interaction between legal scholarship and law, that legal scholarship doesn't translate necessarily into law, but at some point, those who have to write laws do have to refer back to the body of scholarship in their subject. And so I think it is an indirect connection, and I wish that the model of the Dalai Lama were more readily available. But on the other hand, I don't think we should assume that Christian doctrine or any other religious doctrine is absolutely static and unchangeable.
Yeah, well, I'm not making that point. If just for 30 seconds, if I could just say that what troubles me, and I know troubles Richard about this, is that religious people tend not to be honest about where those changes are coming from. They're coming from, to my mind, the hammer blows of modernity that make certain religious doctrines untenable. So, for instance, now the Pope is rethinking the doctrine about contraception. You know, yeah. maybe a married couple, within the context of a marriage, if one is HIV positive, maybe it's okay to use a condom. Let's say he gives ground on that.
Yeah.
That will not be a sign of the vibrancy of Christian dialogue getting to the truth of the matter. That will be a sign of a given religious dogma becoming untenable in the face of its practical consequences and in the face of the fact that there's no good reason to have it there in the first place. And so what Pat is referencing about the Dalai Lama is quite a bit more seditious than that. I mean, the Dalai Lama has said, if science proves any principle of Buddhism to be incorrect, science wins. Now, that is a much more radical statement coming from the head of a church. And what I heard Richard saying, which I fully agree with, is if these are all just books, you know, we have a choice between having a 21st century dialogue about ethics and the nature of reality, or we can fixate ourselves in the first century if we're going to hold to the New Testament, or the seventh century if we're going to hold to the Quran. Uh-huh. And if there's something good in the Bible that is really standing the test of time, which I think there is, I mean, it's not much of it, I don't think, but the Golden Rule, for instance, I think is one of the most beautiful uh-huh. distillations of our ethical impulses. We can use the Golden Rule uh-huh. in the 21st century without believing anything preposterous. And we can see the wisdom of it, and then we can jettison all the rest that we effectively jettison anyway, because nobody's reading Leviticus now and saying we should be killing people for working on the Sabbath.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's an interesting program. So, I mean, we'll see how that plays out.
Could we just... one quick comment from Neil, and then Carolyn Porker, I think, will take us to the break. And I think we'll have a chance later on for doing more about the Dalai Lama.
I actually only had a couple of simple comments, but then you invited me down here, and now I'm all steeped in Buddhist philosophy. I was really going to just make a couple of... I wanted to tidy up a couple of loose ends that were dangling. One of them is the fact that you were citing... not to generalize, but sort of sexist philosophy's influence on the science that gets done or interpreted for biology, and using that to generalize what's bad about science or what needs to be fixed about science, when in fact that's a frontier of science that is subject to the vagaries of funding and of bias. But that's the skin on this growing apple that is science. Science is this collection of understandings that works. And if you're only going to look at the frontier of that, of course, it's going to flip back and forth. And so that is not the measure of what science is. The measure of science is the body of knowledge and understanding that sits behind us right now. And we're standing on that firmly because evidence and experiment and the application of scientific methods has demonstrated that. And so I just want to just make it clear that, and reflecting on Sam's point, by the way, if that proves to be false, those assertions, okay. It'll probably be proved to be false not by a sociologist who declares it's false because it doesn't sound good sociologically, but because there's evidence that says that it's untenable. But a different point I wanted to make was regarding you made this point about estrogen and the fluctuations of scientific truth on the frontier. There's a term in the equation here that has not been mentioned, and that is the role of the media. While it is true that occasionally a scientist will conduct a press conference, that happened with Stanley Pons and Fleischmann for Cold Fusion. And by the way, no other responsible scientific lab was able to verify those conclusions, and so it was quickly removed from the table of science. But if you look at what medical journalists do, they subscribe to the New England Journal of Medicine, and it lands in their office, and they comb the top pages, and they make news stories on what are scientific results that are just fresh out and unverified by other groups, unreverified by the same group, perhaps. And so that's part of the equation of the confusion of the public. I'm agreeing with you that we have to be, as a community, sensitive to what the public who hears the scientific result is to think when they see it flipping back and forth. And the media and the scientists who are exposed to the media need to be much more sensitive about reporting the uncertainties of a result or the reliability or the repeatability of that result as it comes forth. And so, but to indict an entire industry or community because that's how it comes out on the edges, I think undersells the true value of science to the world.
Yeah, I think your point is similar to Francisco's, and I apologize if I have castigated science as a whole. So just to be clear, once again, I'm talking about trying to understand someone in the public who can't tell whether the needle is flipping back and forth, and trying to understand the position that that person is in, and that person has to be more than scientifically literate. They actually have to make a call on a scientific claim, and I think that's
asking a lot. A lot of that burden is on the journalist, I would say.
Now, but the other thing is that I still think, if I may say, that there's a slight glossing over of scientific culpability in this, because if we take another, in the case of the estrogen and breast cancer and so on, of course, it was subsequent work did not confirm it and it was changed. But then there's the issue of the gay gene that was reported by Hammer. Now, we know that's not been confirmed, and yet that hasn't been withdrawn from the table. And over again, there are scientific claims that are not true and that we all know are not true, but are not pulled off. So I don't think that that our slate is as clean as you'd like to believe, and I'd like to believe. And I think that therefore, in a circumstance like this, where we're all here and we can promise to do a better job, we have to put our dirty linen on the table and just acknowledge that.
I can have one last comment on Richard Dawkins. It'll be quick. I was in the back row as you spoke, and so I could see sort of a whole room as the words came out of your mouth as beautifully as they always do and as articulately as they always do. And let me just say, your commentary had a sharpness of teeth that I had not even projected for you. It was my first time meeting medium, and so I felt you more than I heard you, and I ask the question, and this gets back a little to what Francisco was getting at. You're a professor of the public understanding of science, not professor of delivering truth to the public, and these are two different exercises. One of them is you put the truth out there, and like you said, they either buy your book or they don't. Well, that's not being an educator, that's just putting it out there. Being an educator is not only getting the truth right, but there's got to be an act of persuasion in there as well. Persuasion isn't always, here's the facts, you're either an idiot or you're not. It's here are the facts, and here is a sensitivity to your state of mind, and it's the facts plus the sensitivity, when convolved together, creates impact. And I worry that your methods and how articulately barbed you can be ends up simply being ineffective when you have much more power of influence than what is currently reflected in your output.
I gratefully accept the rebuke. I just one anecdote to show that I'm not the worst in this thing. a former and highly successful editor of New Scientist magazine, who actually built up New Scientist to great new heights, was asked, what is your philosophy at New Scientist? And he said, our philosophy at New Scientist is this: science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Well, on that note, we will continue this conversation, but I do want to just to go out to the break with Carolyn Porco, who senior imaging, the imaging scientist, the lady who runs Saturn, as Neil said, the Cassini mission, which is imaging Saturn, and was also at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and I first met her, I don't know, 20 years ago during the Voyager mission, I suppose, right, at JPL. And Carolyn will take us, to use a phrase of Carl Sagan's, knee-deep in the cosmic overwhelm, I hope. So, Carolyn Porco. And you can either stay there and be part of a slideshow, or because we're now going to put the house lights down, and I think we'll see some images.
Saturn needs a stage unto itself.
Saturn needs a stage to itself.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Roger asked me to speak briefly on the...
I asked everybody to speak briefly, but it's done no good. I mean,
so I don't have to feel obliged to speak briefly. On the subject of if not God, then what? And he asked me specifically to talk about what being in this profession that I'm in and staring, as he put it, staring immensity and eternity in the face every day does for one's view of life and spirituality.
I said that?
You did.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you.
And then he asked me to do the Carl Sagan thing and speak about awe and wonder. So I'm going to start by saying that I am in awe of how wonderful it is to be among all of you today and to be among the illustrious speakers who are on the agenda. Yeah. Thank you, Roger, for the invitation. Okay. It is an honor. And I'm going to need a... Here we go. And I think that if anyone has got a replacement for God that is answering the question, if not God, then what, I think that scientists do. So I'm going to disagree, I think, strongly with what we heard Steve Weinberg say, and that's why this meeting has been so interesting, because people come to it with different points of view. I just want to say, though, that it's remarkable to me that in all these years, the years during which Bertrand Russell was alive and since he's died, no one has figured out that there are probably a billion China teapots in orbit around the sun. They just all happen to be affixed to the Earth, but they're still orbiting the sun. So, so somebody should take that statement and just stick an Alpha Centauri in there and take out the sun, because the way it's stated, it's incorrect. Anyway, before one can think about replacing God, one has to find out or ask the question what role God plays. That is, why do people need God and why do people need religion? And in my mind, they are two very, very different things. They're two different, distinct questions, because the God concept and the religion and religion are related, but they're not the same. And I'm going to have to be taking a drink of water here at some point. And there are, of course, lots of different, many different concepts of God, and the one that's most relevant to what I'm going to say is the conceptual device that people employ to feel connected to something grander and something greater than they are. This is the idea, God is omnipotent and omniscient and immortal, and he made me in his image and likeness. And then through that connection to this great being in the sky that I look like and I'm, you know, I was made by, through that connection to find meaning and purpose in their lives, and ultimately to find reason to believe that they too will be immortal. And I believe that we've skirted around an issue that I think is just absolutely core to everything, this conflict of science and religion, and that is that people fear death, okay? We have a tremendous fear of death and the uncertainty of what lies after death, and I think it's a strong factor in all of this, and I'm going to say more about that later. But I think that the same spiritual fulfillment that people find in religion can be found in science. This is counter to what Steve Weinberg said. Because to me, at the heart of every scientific inquiry is a deep spiritual quest, and that is a quest to know and a quest to feel a connection to the natural world by comprehending it, and, you know, by coming to know, if you will, the mind of God. And this is certainly what drove me to be a scientist and to be an astronomer. My own personal quest began when I was a young teenager, and I actually went through a period of time, it only lasted a few months, but I went through a period of time where I very, very earnestly tried to practice the religion that I was born into, which was Catholicism. And that didn't do it for me. It just wasn't gratifying enough. And I was all engaged in asking the questions, the big questions of wonder. What are we doing here? And what is the purpose of us being here? Why am I personally, individually here? And to find out, I turned to the study of astronomy. And it seemed to me if there were going to be any answers to be found at all, they were going to be found in the facts and in understanding the greater theater within which human life has unfolded. And I was right about that. Being a scientist and staring immensity and eternity in the face every day is about as meaningful, I think, and grand and awe-inspiring as it gets. We astronomers, confront the big questions of wonder every day, and the answers to these questions in the aggregate have produced, and this is with absolutely no hype, have produced the greatest story that's ever been told, and there isn't a religion, I think, that can offer anything better. And as Jules Verne said, reality provides us with facts so romantic that imagination itself could add nothing to them. And I say amen to that. So we have a story that has been built up through scientific investigation of, you know, the development of the universe, of the seemingly miraculous conversion of mere energy to matter. I mean, what seems more miraculous than that? Of the development over billions of years, the development of fundamental particles to DNA, of the development of microbes to humans, and of the singularity of the Big Bang ultimately creating the unimaginable vastness that we have all around us in the universe. And this is a story with drama, with spectacle, with magnificence, and so on. And so I'm going to take you through just a few scenes from this movie. You've seen them many times before, but I just thought it stood repeating, and besides, I was tasked with inspiring you with awe and wonder, and so that's what I'm going to do. And so this is our Earth, as you know. We're going to step back, and we're going to go not quite to the Big Bang. I couldn't find a graphic for the Big Bang, but you all know in the scientific story, we all began with the Big Bang. But this is the Hubble Deep Field. It is the deepest picture that was ever created. I think that's still true. You can see this whole potpourri of objects. Everything in here is a galaxy. And we see galaxies here that developed 800 million years after the Big Bang. So we're looking back something like 13 billion light years ago, and also 13 billion light years away. You all know you look backwards, you look out into the universe, and the farther out you go, the farther backwards in time you go. And then there are galaxies that look kind of normal in this image. There are spirals, there are ellipticals, and so on. And these are the younger galaxies here. They're closer to us. So right away we see that there are galaxies, there have been galaxies inhabiting the universe for billions of years. This is just a particular group of galaxies. They are dynamically connected. They are involved in this ballet which transpires on timescales of hundreds of millions of years. And they act gravitationally the way they do because the universe was not completely uniform after the Big Bang. There were seeds of, you know, concentrations of denser than average places in both radiation and then ultimately in matter, and these coalesced under the force of gravity to give us groups of galaxies, and then those broke off to be galaxies, and then the galaxies themselves, as you know, condensed out to be stars. This is the beautiful Sombrero Galaxy, 28 million light years from Earth, about 50,000 light years across. This disk spiral, this here is the dust and gas, but you're seeing here the dust that has settled down into the disk of the galaxy. Here is a barred galaxy. Not all galaxies are the same. They're not shaped the same. This is a beautiful barred spiral. And then this is just one of the most beautiful a lot of detail in this Whirlpool galaxy, and you can see the red regions are the star-forming regions when in the rotation of matter around the center of the galaxy, large molecular clouds are sent through a region, these spiral arms, which are actual dynamical entities. They themselves rotate around the galaxy with a different speed. When these large molecular clouds pass through this region, they are compressed, and out pop, on the other side, out pop a lot of blue stars. You can see that here, too. You can see blue stars kind of on the outside of these spiral arms. And then we find galaxies that are in the process of merging. There's galactic cannibalism going on. This is how galaxies grow in size, and this is this beautiful merger we're viewing here. And anyway, so you can see that we've learned quite a lot just by looking out into the universe. We know that there are lots of other galaxies. Ours is not the only one. When we look inside our own galaxy, so we're looking at things that are tens of thousands of light years away, we find lots of regions where stars are being born. This here is the Orion Nebula. It's the middle star in the sword of Orion. And this here, not too far away, is the Horsehead Nebula. These are regions where stars are being born. And this, of course, is the famous Eagle Nebula that Reverend Neil referred to. Really, Neil is going to be our first minister of our Church of Scientists. He's got what it takes. Anyway, here are these little cocoons that are illuminated, in fact, by stars, bright stars, out of the picture above. They illuminate these dense clouds of molecular hydrogen and also dust, and they actually evaporate. The ultraviolet light evaporates the material, leaving these little cocoons. Actually, they're called eggs, and inside each of these is an embryonic star, and the size of these little cocoons is about the size of our solar system. So obviously, everywhere we look, we find exactly what we find here around us. There is nothing extraordinary in seeing in anything that we have around us. And here's just a close-up of that region that I pointed out to you. And then finally, looking only 32 light years away, this is actually, there's a red dwarf star here, and you can see once the light of the star is blocked out, you could see that this star is enveloped with a disk. This is a disk of dust and debris. It's something across like 4 or 5 times the classical limit of our solar system, that is out to about the orbit of Neptune. Of course, we have the Kuiper belt, and that goes out far. So it's about the size of our solar system, or a little bit larger if you consider our Kuiper belt. But now we find disks around other stars. They're common. We're finding planets around other stars. We have something, I think I lose count, because we're discovering so many of them. I don't remember how many there are now, but I think when last I read about this, we had something like 200 planets around other stars. We haven't yet found any terrestrial-like planets, small planets, because they're very difficult to see. But I think with time, it's inevitable. All we need is for the astronomical instrumentation to get capable enough for us to see those evidence of those very small planets around other stars. But planets themselves are common. So we can see that what we find here around us is not unique. And we are continuing in this. We're continuing the trend that began, of course, long ago, most recently with Copernicus. We are losing our very special place in the cosmos. But what about life? Okay, that's a holdover. I mean, the faithful like to hold on to that. What about life? Well, a cardinal goal in the exploration of the planets today is the search for habitable zones in our solar system. And that means long-lived liquid water environments that have also simple organic materials within them and excess warmth. Okay, this has been such a compelling question to see if life was the only place in our solar system, if the Earth was the only place in our solar system where life arose, that this issue of finding other places where it might possibly have arisen, and of course I'm talking only about microbes or even just self-replicating molecules, that it has become a prime thrust for our planetary program. And this brings me to Saturn. As you heard, I am the leader of the scientists who take all these beautiful pictures of Saturn. And here is one of those beautiful pictures in natural color. And I want to point out to you, first of all, that this is Saturn's rings looked at exactly edge on. They are phenomenally thin. And in fact, we know that the processes that go on in Saturn's rings are very similar to the processes that go on in the spiral galaxies and also in those debris disks that we find around other stars. So we actually have the capability of understanding those processes by watching, by examining what is contained in Saturn's rings. But I want to call your attention to this little body here. It's called Enceladus. It's no bigger than the state of Arizona. It's very small, and it is a very unusual moon. We could tell just by looking at its surface early on in the mission that it was unlike all the other icy satellites around Saturn. It has very few craters, and that means that the surface is young. You can only look at this to know it is completely tectonically tortured, this satellite. It's had a very complex geological history. And sometime around July of 05, we executed an extraordinarily close flyby of Enceladus. We flew closer to Enceladus than any other moon in the Saturn system, only 175 kilometers above the surface. And then at that point, we were staring at the south polar region of Enceladus. And now this is where all our attention is on this moon. It is characterized by a ring of fractures and folds and mountain belts that is contiguous, completely goes around the south pole. And you're looking at the south polar region right here. It's characterized by these fractures. This is a false color image. Enceladus is almost completely white because it's completely water ice, except for these cracks where we find they are, in fact, distinctly colored here because we find simple organic materials are coincident with these fractures. And then another remarkable result is that we have found that the hottest place, the warmest place on Enceladus is the South Pole. That's as bizarre as finding that the South Pole, the Antarctic of the Earth, is warmer than the equator. That's how remarkable this result is. And the hottest region in the South Polar region are these fractures. Okay, and then as if that weren't enough, we found that issuing forth from these fractures are jets of fine icy particles extending, here you can see tens of kilometers into the space above Enceladus. And when we take an image like this and we color code it to bring out the faint light levels, we find that these jets feed an extensive plume, and in other pictures we've found that this plume extends for 7 or 8 Enceladus diameters. It is a remarkable, dramatic finding. And when my team and I have taken these images and the other information collected by Cassini, we have found that it is possible that these jets are in fact geysers that are issuing forth from subterranean chambers of liquid water close to the surface of Enceladus. So this is a remarkable finding. If we are correct, and remember we have liquid water, we have simple organic materials, we have excess warmth. If we are correct, then we may have just stumbled upon the holy grail of modern day exploration, and that is an environment that is possibly suitable for living organisms. And the prospects of that, as you can well imagine, are thrilling. If we are correct, and if we find eventually that Genesis has occurred independently twice in our solar system, and that is a big if. But if we are correct about the liquid water, and if at some point, perhaps in a revisit to Enceladus with another mission, we find that there are living organisms beneath the surface, and in fact, perhaps even captured in these plumes, then we can, I think, be assured that Genesis has occurred a staggering number of times throughout the life of the cosmos. The 13.7 billion year life of the cosmos, a conclusion that you might imagine could prove very difficult for standard religious doctrine. So what about now this issue of death and immortality? I think that belief in God, in the God concept, brings with it a guarantee of immortality, and that's why people find it so attractive. People are afraid of death, and I think the approach to death in our culture is a colossal failure. We don't talk about it. We don't teach people how to anticipate it, how to feel about it, and people are afraid to die. Okay? But, and do we have anything in the story that I just told you that can comfort those who wish to live forever? I don't think so, because people as we are constituted right now, are not going to live forever. But, I mean, that is just the simple truth of it. But I think that there may be another way to look at death and immortality that can be taught. And I believe that it is possible to learn to regard death as a natural event, an event that is part of the natural order of things, and even perhaps a wondrous state. And it is a transition that takes place against and within the beautiful pageantry and majesty that I just showed you in the story that we have constructed and what we see around us in the universe. And, you know, that is something that can be taught to be a comforting thought. And after all, we know exactly what it's like to be dead, because it is exactly like the state we inhabited before we were born, and there's nothing in that to be afraid of. And I think we can, in fact, offer hope of sorts for an everlasting existence. I mean, our mortal bodies, of course, are going to perish and decay, but the collection of individual pieces of matter and individual particles that within us we have learned are ancient, and we'll go on, after we die, we'll go on and go back into the cosmos and live forever. But in one form or another, whether they live on as matter or they get converted to energy, they will, in fact, last forever. And I believe that we can and we should teach people to find comfort in that thought in the way that children are taught to find comfort in the God concept. Someone mentioned emotional dividends. I think we should teach this as an emotional dividend of the science story. And we can find comfort in knowing that someday everyone who has ever lived on this planet will someday adorn the heavens, looking very much like the nebulae that are created when a sun-like star sheds its outer layers and dies. So maybe one day we may look like this. This is the death of a solar star, a star just like our sun, which shed its outer layers. And in an event like this, a few billion years from now, it will happen on our star. All life on the Earth will perish, and the materials on the Earth, the water and organic matter, will be evaporated into space. So we may, in fact, look like this, or like this. And I find it actually a very enchanting and intriguing thought to think that in looking at these nebulae, we might be looking at elements, the carbon, the oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen that once were recycled through the organisms of an extraterrestrial civilization that lived on a planet that orbited this star. But anyway, one day this will be us. So I think we can, in fact, replace the God concept, that is, the God as the explanation of all things natural, and I think, in fact, we've already done it. It's just a matter of developing a socially appealing way to get the word out to everybody. Which brings me to religion and whether or not anything having to do with scientific inquiry, whether it's the practice of science or the fruits of it, could ever offer the social embrace that religious organizations do. And I was intrigued, actually, very intrigued. I think this is the only thing I agreed with in the comments of Steven Weinberg, that I was intrigued to hear him say that he knows people who belong to religions, and when he talks to them one-on-one, they're not so sure. I think he used the word woozy. Did he use the word woozy?
Woolly.
Anyway, that there are people who maybe didn't really believe everything, but they were part of religions anyway. They were group members. And that I found that, you know, interesting, because it underscores my suspicion that I think a lot of people who belong to religions, I'm not so sure they're completely hard over 100% certain that there's a God. You know, maybe they fill out these polls and they say, yes, I believe in God. Maybe, you know, that's what they feel they have to do. I wouldn't be surprised if they're really not so certain. But they are attracted to religions. We are social animals. We love to belong to groups. And so I think the reasons for religion are primarily social, and that many of them may be on the fence about God and other teachings. I mean, just take Catholics and John Paul II. People loved John Paul II. I actually loved John Paul II. How could you not love such a lovable old man? But A lot of Catholics did not buy what he had to say about the use of contraceptives. So they took some of it, they rejected the others. I think the desire to belong to religion and religious groups is a paramount drive here that I think we can address. And here I offer a possibly crazy idea, maybe it's a dangerous idea, that to bring the findings of science and the astonishing story of the universe that science has to tell, to bring that to everyone, we should let the success of the religious formula guide us. And we could debate this endlessly, and there's lots of things that we could talk about adopting that religions do and do well. But I'll just mention a few. We could replace the social organizations of religion with something else. Someone said, but religions do so many good things. There was $1 billion gathered by religious organizations and delivered to the Katrina victims. And that's a phenomenally wonderful thing. It's a desire in humans we want to encourage. I don't see why the organizations that do that have to be based on religion. We can develop other organizations that do that. But have the same kind of bond, give people the same kind of thing that religion gives them. Let's teach our children from a very young age about the story of the universe and its incredible richness and beauty. It is already so much more glorious and awesome and even comforting than anything offered by any scripture or God concept that I know of. And I think a large part of the discussions and the debates that we're having is that it's true, we're not going to convert the adults. People very rarely change their minds, so it's kind of hopeless to be talking about taking all the Islamic fundamentalists today and trying to convert them. It's not going to happen. I agree with someone, whoever said that, it's probably not going to happen. But we can teach the younger generation. There's hope for the younger generation. Someone used the term gradual illuminations of the mind, and I think that's the key, the operative phrase here. And then finally, we could celebrate. Okay, we have a great many reasons for jubilation. That we actually can know what we know is so empowering and uplifting, at least to me as a scientist. I get off on that all the time. How we can actually know the things that we know is just a beautiful thing, and it's worth celebrating. How about instituting a national holiday to honor all the knowledge that humankind has created, has accumulated over the last how many years about the universe and evolution and so on? How about a holiday called the Day of Great Awakening? You know, let's put it on the ballot. And we've already had, in our brief history, we've already had many moments that deserved such recognition and celebration, and I'm just going to remind you of a few of them. This, as you know, was the first time we ever saw Earth as a whole planet from space. It was taken on December 29th, 1968, by the astronauts orbiting the moon from Apollo 8. It had an enormous impact on our view of our place and in the cosmos and our planetary home. It certainly was a moment that I think deserved celebration. And then, of course, there's the famous pale blue dot. This is not the best picture of it, but this was the picture taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft when it was far above the plane of the solar system, and out beyond the orbit of Neptune. I'm very proud to say I played a part in the taking of this, I played a part in the effort, which was led, in fact, by Carl Sagan in taking this picture, the significance of which Carl wrote so eloquently about in his book, The Pale Blue Dot. And now I'm also tremendously proud to say that Cassini, the spacecraft that I'm associated with, and our cameras in particular, have made their own contribution to this collection of celestial views of our home planet. On September 15th, just whatever that is, a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago, Cassini's trajectory took it far from the planet, far from Saturn, and deep into the shadow of the planet's shadow. And from there, shielded from direct sunlight, we were able to point our cameras back in the direction of the sun, which is something we really can't do when the sun is not shielded, when the spacecraft is not protected from direct sunlight. We were able to look in the direction of the sun and take a series of images of the entire inner Saturnian system. And these images have been mosaic together to produce a view that no human has ever seen before. This was a total eclipse of the sun seen from the other side of Saturn. And here you see the planet, you see its main rings, which are illuminated by, from below, from light scattered within the rings. We see the largest ring itself. This is the E-ring. In fact, this ring is the result of the exhalations of Enceladus, of these fine icy particles that are emerging from the interior of Enceladus and orbiting the planet. And it is a wild thought indeed, I tell you, to think that if there are microbes on Enceladus, they are being shut out of the moon, frozen in these tiny particles, and they're orbiting Saturn in this ring. We don't know if that's the case, but like I said, it's a wild thought. And as if this spectacle weren't dazzling enough, we can spot from across a billion miles of interplanetary space our own planet Earth nestled in the arms of Saturn's rings, right there. And so I think it will probably be a long time before we see anything this moving again. But I believe that, coming from where I come from, maybe it's not hard to imagine I believe this way, but I don't think anything has greater power to alter and correct our perception of ourselves and our place in the cosmos than the sight of our own small little world from across the depths of space. In the end, this ever-widening view of Earth against the immensity of space is perhaps the greatest legacy of all our interplanetary travels and of all our scientific inquiry. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you. What did I do?
You did good. Just a couple of comments, but then I think we need to go to, there's a coffee break coming up. But one is that if there's microbes developing, perhaps if I applied early, I could get the job of God on Enceladus, do you think? I think we're going to go to break. So. Just a comment there, Carolyn, that when those images, some of those images came back of the Earth from space, do you remember what Jim Lovell read? Yeah. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Yeah. So we have this this bind going on all the time. I also remember a story that was told me by Ed Krupp, who's director of the Griffith Observatory, which is, I suppose, reopening this weekend. And we were doing a series called The Human Quest, and I was asking Ed about the sort of sense that people had of the universe. And he told me a story that in the, I don't remember exactly which year it was, probably the early 90s, that one night the Griffith Observatory started getting masses of phone calls from people. And they couldn't understand why there was the sudden traffic in phone calls. And everybody was asking what was different about the sky that night. And there was something happened with the sky. Why was it different? And they finally figured it out after a while, that the Northridge earthquake had in fact not knocked out all sorts of power lines. And for the first time, people were seeing stars. People who lived in the valley and so on had not seen stars before like that. And suddenly there was this huge... And he made the point that this is the bind we're in. We have this capacity for all this knowledge and so on, yet we occlude it with man-made objects and so on. On your question about living for a long time, perhaps we're planning to do a conference at some point on aging and life extension. And if the projections of Aubrey de Grey are correct, that it's just an engineering problem, and we'll be able to, there are about 13 problems, we'll solve them, extend our life 40 years at a time, and perhaps we'll live for a very, very long time. After the break, we'll come back with... can we make this a short break, just about 15 minutes, just a quick coffee and